myself in fever dreams, and you were there, and you were there, so were you, and so was I. Oh, making all this up, and so was I. Led through magnetic fields, my compass spun like a roulette wheel. It took all night to find my way home. Sigh arose with celestial light that poured in through my window's eye.
Feeling lost in the lonely, meaningless cyberweb? Looking to connect with other users? Then plug in to a CITR collective. Meet users who are compatible with your interests and passions. CITR's mainframe offers 9 unique collectives: news, arts, accessibility, sports, persons of color, indigenous, gender empowerment, LGBTQ2SIA+, and music affairs. CITR collectives are where you can make great radio, great friends, and avoid the abject loneliness of life in the cyber void.
Hi, this is Dick Valentine from Electric Six. You're listening to CITR 101.9, University of British Columbia.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded, Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Hi everyone, my name is Arthi and you're listening to Season 6's All Access Pass on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm joined by my Accessibility Collective teammates, Jesse, Deepi, Monica, Helena, and Stephanie. I hope everyone's keeping well and staying safe. The team and I have another really good show lined up for you today. In honor of February's Black History Month, we have Tina Huintiti Opeleke with us here on All Access Pass. However, before we chat with Tina, let's go to our first song break. Here's Monica with the first song.
Hi, Arthi and everyone. So our first song of the show is called Honey Na by Turinesh and off the album Coastal Cider. Welcome back to All Access Pass on CITR 101.9 FM. The song you just heard was called Honey Not Hennessy by Turinesh and off the album Coastal Cider. A little bit about this artist. She is an experimental neo-Afro-soul singer-songwriter of Tanzanian and Ethiopian origin. Her music is inspired by her East African roots, and her 2019 album, Coastal Cider, merges sounds and languages from Eastern and Western Africa. She is based in Vancouver and actually, fun fact, attended UBC for her undergraduate study.
Thanks, Monica. Now we are very pleased to start our show topic, and we have a very special guest with us here today. She's a behavioral therapist, co-founder of Prosthetics for Foreign Donation, and co-author of the book Until We Are Free, an advocate and a mother. Here is Tina Opeleke. Welcome to All Access Pass, Tina. Thank you so much for joining us and taking the time to speak with us today.
Thanks for having me. Our first question is, we're just starting off with, who would you describe Tina Quintiti Opaliki to be?
How would I describe myself to be? Oh, that's a great question. So I definitely am a warrior. That's factual. And I would say, yeah, like I'm, when I describe myself, yes, I am part warrior, kind of part dragon. Definitely full of love, but I am a disability advocate. I am somebody who never used to use her voice. And one day that stopped and my voice became one of my most powerful gifts that I have. And I now am somebody who I'm like the anti-bully. So if I see any kind of injustice happening, any kind of discrimination, it's like my duty as, you know, rent on this universe to speak up for those who sometimes don't have a voice. And I would say, yeah, above all, I do things out of love for people. And also for the times when nobody was there for me, I know how that feels. And I will always be a support to those in need. So yeah, that's kind of me in a nutshell.
That is interesting. So now going back to the past, what was life like for you growing up?
So I'm born with club feet, and once you have reconstructive surgery to your legs, which I spent my childhood in a lot of casts to straighten the lower half extremities of my legs. So, you know, I knew I was born with my feet interned, and, you know, it's what they call pigeon feet. Like, I always turn my feet inward when I'm comfortable. So I saw myself as disabled, but nobody else saw me that way. So I felt very misunderstood, actually, as a child. I never took my disability for granted. And the fact that, you know, my parents were really on top of making sure I slept with corrective shoes on and all those things, so that now, you know, I have less struggles when it comes to my physical disability. But as a youth, you know, both of my parents are academics. We grew up in a very white neighborhood. So I face a lot of racism from, you know, children in my neighborhood. There was a special needs wing in my school, and a lot of those children were bullied. So I spent my recesses kind of really hanging out with them, because I was like, you guys are like me. And really being highly protective of people with disabilities in school from others, and really of racial injustice. So I had a teacher removed from our school who called my brother a nigger. So, you know, that kind of thing, I felt, you know, a lot of the faculty tiptoed around me as well. I was kind of this force. But, you know, I was just me, this little girl. I didn't really know what I was doing. I was just like, you can't say that to us. That's not okay. You're an elder. And I've never had an adult talk to me like that. So, I've always been a little advocate and a little activist. I just didn't know. So I spent a lot of my time, I would say, by myself, because I couldn't relate to a lot of people. I really couldn't relate to a lot of people through my experiences as a child. And that has carried through. You know, I'm kind of a different being than most beings that I meet. And that's okay. I've come to love that part of myself. But as a youth, that was really hard. That was really hard. And I didn't really see anybody with physical disabilities. It's so strange, but you don't really see anybody. And you don't see them like wearing their disability. This was definitely the early 80s. So when I went to school and through the 90s, but yeah, I was usually the only one, you know, other than those with special needs, which usually intersex developmental disability. So, yeah, I spent a lot of time by myself, kind of president of my school, doing science experiments in the bush. And I was in the prairies, so catching tadpoles and trying to grow them into frogs. That's kind of my childhood. I'm the youngest of six children. So when you have a lot of siblings, a lot of family members, a big family, you don't really seek friends. You spend a lot of time with your cousins and those who are related to you. So that's my childhood. It was beautiful, though, in so many ways. in my family unit, but outside of my family unit, yeah, I was kind of a, I always describe myself as a paradox. Like I tend to be alone in a crowd of people.
Yeah, well, thank you for sharing that with us. Now, can you please tell us a little bit about your disability?
Yeah, so being born with club feet, you're born with your feet interned, and it really affects your knees, also your back. Well, at least for me, I developed scoliosis at about the age of 14. So that's a curvature of the spine. So I did a lot of posture classes, wearing a body brace to kind of straighten your spine. And I slept with corrective shoes when I slept to kind of turn your feet outwards and train the lower half of your legs to be straight. But they never really straightened. So most of my baby, you know, most of my younger pictures, I'm just sitting there with casts on my legs, trying to straighten, yeah, the lower half. So that's basically club feet. But I mean, if you do not wear corrective shoes and braces for your legs, then it's kind of like your legs could be very bowed. You can have knock knees. It's all dependent. But yeah, if your parents have access to certain resources, then absolutely you will get the club feet shoes and the braces that you will wear. I think I wore them well into, I think around four or five is when I stopped wearing braces. And then I just was really conscious of walking, which to this day, I like heel to toe. Like you do it subconsciously, but I think about walking straight when I walk all the time. And that just became a part of my disability, you know? And when I get lazy or when I'm tired, I'll be walking like this, you know, with feet turned in front of the other. So that's club feet. And then scoliosis, like I said, is curvature of the spine. So that just affected my alignment and those type of things. But my ankles crack, my toes crack, my knees crack, I would say at least 30 to 40 times a day. And that's just, I thought it was normal until people are around me. They're like, why is your body cracking? I was like, oh, you don't do this? And they're like, no, not at all. So those are just things I realize as I've grown about my disability, that certain things my body does that I don't think other people's bodies do.
Oh, wow. Thank you for that. That was a lot of information that I did not know about. Another question is, when did you realize or could tell that your son had a disability? Can you tell us what that was like?
Yes, this is fueling the next chapter of my life. So my son is my second born. I have a daughter, Ayomide, and my son, Ayanaja Babajidi. My daughter was 11 when he was born. So I remember her birth and, you know, you check the limbs, you check the toes, everything. It's just, you know, the check after the birth. And I was holding my son and just one of his legs just looked different from the other. But he was, you know, they're so tiny and squinched up when they're newborn. So it's really hard to see their extremities properly, but something just didn't look right. So I held him in the football position, which if anybody knows, you know, you hold a child over your forearm. And when his legs were hanging, I could very much see that his right leg was shorter than the left leg. So I actually called the nurse in because they were getting ready to discharge us from the hospital. It's my second day after giving birth. I mean, I'm so grateful. My births were only 4 hours. You know, I'm very fit and things. So I had really easy births. So, yeah, I called a nurse and I just said, like, his leg just looks different. Does it look different to you? And when she held him, her entire energy changed. And so my energy changed and you know, she just kind of got worrisome. So then I'm worried. And she was like, I'll bring him right back, which she disappears with my child. And when they bring him back to me, it was probably about 45 minutes later. And my doctor brings him back. And they begin to tell me that he was just born with PFFD. What is called PFFD, it's a congenital birth deficiency affecting his hip, his pelvis, and his femur. I just as an athlete, you know, femur is, you know, usually the strongest, longest, you know, bone. It's a very important bone in your body to carry your body weight and just with walking, with everything. So, yeah, she was panicked. And then she showed me this x-ray that looked like this jumbled up spine and legs and hips. So basically, I left the hospital thinking my son would never walk, like never walk. Because I couldn't understand how he would walk with two legs that were different lengths. And then they just began to send me to the geneticist and things like this and make appointments. But nobody gave me any real information. They were basically like, your child's born with a deficiency. He may never walk. You know, you are discharged from the hospital. All the best. And that never sat right with me to the point that I feel like right now to this day, children who are born with disabilities, you should have a family or somebody meet you who has experience with that to welcome you to the world of disabilities, because it's a fantabulous world to belong to. And they made it sound like, oh no, you know? And again, being more with club feet, I was like, why are you talking like this is a bad thing? You know, where it's going to be a different thing, but they definitely talked about it like it was a bad thing. Like I should definitely be worried. And, you know, my stomach dropped. I was so distraught for my child, and I knew he was going to struggle, and nothing I could do is going to change that. So it broke my heart. Yeah, it broke my heart. It broke my heart how they left it with me. And then it turned into being one of the greatest, most beautiful things that's ever happened to my life. So, yeah. But at the hospital, shame on them. They did not handle that well. Yeah. So that's when I found out on day two of his life.
Is there any advice that you gave Ionija about living life with a disability? And also, what inspired you to start prosthetics for foreign donation?
Okay. So the first part I will say is, you know, limb loss, like loss of any kind, you actually have to go through grief. So I actually had to work through grief, and I was paired with Champs War Amps, that they had conventions where I can meet other amputee families. So that was the first most greatest support, was like talking to other mothers. Then I was sent to a orthopedic surgeon. This was, I'm pretty sure, at Vancouver General. But anyway, so I went in the appointment. I was like, is my son going to walk? And this man sat down, which, you know, doctors don't really have good bedside manner all the time. But he sat down, looked me dead in my face, and he was like, I am born with no bones in my feet. None. You know, just small bones in my ankle. He's like, my grandma gave me two sticks and told me, if you have your heart, your mind, and your soul, there's nothing you can't do. And he was like, and then on top of that, he has you. He's like, you walked in this room. I could feel your presence when you entered this room. So he's like, I don't even need to know you. Just knowing that he has you behind him, there's nothing he can't do. So he's like, anything they tell you, throw that in the garbage and believe in yourself, follow your intuition, and everything's going to be right as rain. I left that appointment like, yes. Okay. That's what I needed to hear. It just kind of reminded me of myself. And I was like, this is going to be amazing. I don't know, but my son chose this womb, chose me, you know? So I kind of let him teach me, because I didn't know anything about being an amputee. You know, I had my own experiences, but not as an amputee. So it's really interesting. As my son was growing, he just kind of guided everything. So we took a flight. He wanted to take his leg off, which it's like us taking our shoes off. So he took off his leg and passed it to me through the seats, because my children were sitting beside each other. I was sat beside a man who ran an amputee clinic in India, who was on his way to a wedding in New York. And I was on my way to a wedding in New York. So do you see the serendipity of that moment? We talked for like 3 hours about what they do in India and repurposing prosthetics and how they do that, the cost. And this, it just started to plant seeds inside of me. And we hadn't thought of PFFD at that point. But again, I feel like my son is the person who created that conversation. Otherwise, we would have been two strangers sitting beside each other on a flight who probably would have never have spoken unless my son passed that prosthetic through the seats, you know, just him being himself. And then my son was about to have hip surgery. And as a child, they're so resilient. He just thought everybody had surgery and everybody was born with a leg deficiency. So I kind of was like, yeah, well, that's an interesting way of looking at things. I never corrected him. I was just like, yeah, we're going to go with that until you realize that's not true. And just the purity of children. So he was going to have reconstructive hip surgery when he was five. So that was his third surgery, and he's had 11 to date. So we flew to Jamaica for 3 weeks because I thought, if I'm going to be in a body cast for like 3 months, I hope somebody would take me on vacation first, you know? So I thought that was the right thing to do. We went on vacation again, just being ourselves, walking around, buying some fruit. We see a man. Well, I'm buying fruit. I'm fully involved. I was hungry. I was fully involved in the market. My son sees a man using a skateboard, a double leg amputee above the knee, and which at 4 years old, my son was taller than him. So it was the first man that he'd ever been taller than. So he was just so enamored with himself and his height, because he, you know, with his leg off, when he takes off his prosthetic, he's always the shortest child around. So I could just tell they just got into the deepest conversation. And somebody began to call me like, whose child is this? And then I was like, oh, wait, what? That's my child. What's going on here? And everybody was just like, good job, mom. You know, whoever you are raising a great child. Your child just took off his prosthetic and gave it to me. And I was like, oh, that is amazing. Like, what do you mean? And he's like, I told him I have no legs. And your son literally was like, when I get back to Canada, I'll go to my doctor and I'll get him to make me a new leg and you can have this one. And that was the light bulb moment that I was like, okay, if you at 4 years old are willing to give away one of your prosthetics that you will not be using in the next 6 months, what if we start asking other amputees and other, you know, family members of amputees who have passed on, that if they have prosthetics that are in their closet, in their garage, in their attic, would they donate it to us? And I wasn't sure if anybody would say yes. So that's how PFFD started. We just started asking amputees, like, will you share some of your old prosthetics so that we can repurpose them and ship them to people in Africa, in the Caribbean, in Asia, in Nepal, all over the world, Peru, anybody who emails us, we wanted to get prosthetics to. And especially just when my son was 9 months old, he started to walk and he kept trying to reach the floor with his right leg. And of course it didn't reach. So he would completely split his face, split his lip, falling. And I mean, every few weeks he would split his lip and it just broke my heart. And so I went to a prosthetist clinic and tried to get him a prosthetic. And they said, no, they don't make prosthetics until children are at least 12 to 18 months. And I thought, what? So if a child is trying to walk, then cognitively they should have the supports to walk. And, you know, ideal in my world is disabilities and cognition and behavioral, and all these things are interconnected. So I basically had to not threaten, but I would not leave the prosthetic clinic. It became confrontational. They threatened to call the police on me, which I was like, call them. Absolutely. And I'll call Shaw Cable. I'll call everybody down here. And let's talk about this. And we're Canadians and we have a right to get prosthetics. So cast them for a prosthetic. I don't see the big deal. But it took hours. I was there for probably 8 hours to get my son a prosthetic. So I just thought about that. Like, what if there was nowhere I could get him a prosthetic? Am I just going to see my child struggle and fall and, you know, injure himself? That's unfair. So that was the really driving force behind PFFD, is just facilitating mobility. You know, Canada's not perfect, but we have a lot of resources here and a lot of access and accessibility to resources and supports. And imagine that you didn't. That's how PFFD started, that if there's somebody that I can help, If there's a mother, I can get her child a prosthetic, I'm going to do that. Because what PFFD believes is the gift of mobility, it comes wrapped with independence and a renewed sense of dignity. And that's really what anybody wants, is not always to have to ask somebody to, can you push me here? Can you carry me here? Can you help me do this? We want our own independence and our own dignity to get up and do it by ourselves. And really, community and, you know, just needs to create new ways so that there's ramps. But I don't want you to carry me up the stairs. I want a ramp so I can get myself up the stairs, you know? So yeah, we just facilitate mobility so that everybody can have access, the same type of access that we have. And that was how PFFD birthed. And so really, he teaches me so much about his disability, and I just love his disability. So I've never hid it, you know. He designs it. It's always really cool. Sometimes we match his shoes to it. I've just taken him everywhere. I talk about how amazing his prosthetic is. So he's never felt like, oh no, about it, you know? And yeah, most kids, I can't explain it. I guess because he owns it and he loves himself and he knows how much I love him and how I'm a bit of a weirdo. So I think there's mediocre and then there's the rest of us who are different and celebrate our differences and are super proud of our differences. So yeah, he's just in that realm. I'm like, dude, you're amazing. There's everybody else and there's you. So I think he's just grown up hearing that. So he just believes that too, that people say things about his leg and they're just like, oh, they're jealous, mom. I'm like, right? They wish they had a prosthetic as cool as yours. That's usually our response. Yeah, you just kind of meet people with love. Like even when they spew hate at you, there's something inside them that's in pain, you know? So all we can do is just send them some like energetic love and lend them our absence. And that's it. And I always have his back all the time. So any situations in school, I do a lot of advocacy, a lot of education, even with faculty about disabilities, about looking at things from my son's perspective, for one, as a Black person, and then as a Black and disabled person, it's a different lens. So sometimes I feel like you need to give your glasses to somebody else so they can look through your lens. You can't just assume that they know. So yeah, that's kind of how I back up Ionija any way I can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you so much, Tina. It's just amazing to hear like everything that you're saying right now. Before we come back and chat more with Tina, we're going to have a quick little song break. So please stay with us. Monica, take it away.
Thank you, Arthi. So our second song of the show is called Amour d'été by Pierre Quenders, which is produced by Branco, and it's off of the album called Nasso.
Je l'aime comme ça. chérie m'a dit à l'obinangai désiré za danger bolingo yango atana boy a kolimbate a kotikate a kobakisa a kopesa nyonso elle m'a dit méfie toi les amours d'été y a rien de pire qu'un un amour d'été sache que ton désir se cache rien d'autre que le danger viens par là touche moi là
Welcome back to All Access Pass on CITR 101.9 FM. The song you just heard was Amour d'été by Pierre Quenders. A little bit about this artist. So Pierre Quenders is a Canadian singer and songwriter who was born in Kinshasa, which is the capital of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. He immigrated to Canada when he was a teenager, and he has been nominated for several music awards, including the Juno Award for World Music Album of the Year and the Polaris Music Prize. His music has both African and Western influences, and he performs in several different languages.
Thank you, Monica. So to reintroduce our guest again, she is the co-founder of Prosthetics for Foreign Donation, co-author of the book Until We Are Free, an advocate, and a mother. Welcome back to our chat with Tina Quintiti Ovaleke.
Mm-hmm. Hello, hello.
Our next question is there anything you'd like to describe about your family's experience with the biases in the healthcare system as members of the Black community?
This is such a deep wormhole. There are some very interesting beliefs around pain levels. And it's like, I'm the worst person to speak on it because I do have a high tolerance for pain. But that's not because I'm Black. You know, but I do sometimes find people will be rougher, especially as a parent and taking my children in, they will be rough. And I'm like, what are you doing? What? Like, do you see that little girl over there who's 2 years older than my son, but she has blonde hair and blue eyes and you're being super gentle with her? I need you to do that with my son. And I mean, I've had to do that. Like, I've had to like show them, do you see that? It's different. And I need it to be the same. And you know, like I make people's faces turn red. And I know I'm confronting them and I'm putting them in positions, but that's exactly what needs to happen. So that happens a lot, like unbelievably a lot. Just the handling of you is so much rougher. So that's very strange to me. But there are just so many, like, you know, having to being threatened to call the police because I wanted services for my son was so strange to me. I was like, and what are you going to say to them? That I had an appointment that I came to? And you won't, like, it was the strangest thing, but it was everybody in the office was like, oh, just causing a scene. Oh, she's so, I was like, what? Like, they were fully discriminating me in front of my face. And it was mind-boggling. I got a huge apology after, but it's not really about the apology. It's about the audacity. And then still to actually require the services, like you still need the services. So do you let people who treat you less than you deserve actually give you services, or do you go somewhere else? You know, so it's challenging at times. And then in other ways, you know, my son, he was born with dreadlocks. Like I dreadlocked his hair from birth. I have locks in my hair. All my family, we all have natural hair. And when he goes for appointments, they will like, you know, boom, shaka, laka, laka, or they do some kind of like, hey, Bob Marley. I'm like, no, his name's Ionijah. And you're going to, I don't know why you do this. This is so weird to me. Or, you know, always like trying to touch his hair. So I've had to physically restrain people at the wrist. Like they're 1 inch from touching my son's hair. And I'm like, I will grab them. But for me, I will grab your arm and I will stop you from touching him. I don't know who you last touched. I don't know if you washed your hands. And I mean, even now with COVID, just think of pre-COVID, the amount of people who would just touch him in such a way that's so strange. A surgeon said to him, if you wake up and your locks are gone, it wasn't me. I'm like, no, that's actually not funny. And we need to trust you. Like, it was just strange conversations around his locks, questions. I don't know how to really explain it. Even my son will have to have about 24 surgeries over the course of his childhood. And we're 11 surgeries in. So I began to interview surgeons, because just because I meet a surgeon doesn't mean I'm going to trust you with my child. That's another thing I advocate to parents all the time. Internal racism is a real thing. So if I already see you looking at my child like he's a thing, you think I'm going to let you cut him open? You are kidding me. That's not happening. So I have removed 3 surgeons. One, because he refused to make eye contact with me. Like he just wouldn't make eye contact with me. It was the most bonkers thing, but I could tell that he didn't think him and I were on the same level. So I've experienced that. I look younger than my age. I'm in my 40s, but most people assume they talk to me like I'm probably in my late 20s, early 30s, like I'm some young punk or something. So that's very interesting to me when I always have to correct people and let them know, like, are you joking me right now? Soon you'll be calling me a doctor, so don't talk to me like that. But I've had to really correct people. And one of the most renowned surgeons in Toronto for specifically, you know, limb lengthenings, our first conversation, he told me that I should amputate my son's leg so that he can basically be like have swag. I can't remember, he didn't use the word swag, but he tried to use some word from the Ebonics dictionary where I'm not versed in Ebonics. So that was weird. And I don't know if he was trying to relate to me like, you're black, I'm gonna use swag. No, we're talking about limb lengthening. We're talking about bones, ligaments, you know. A medical procedure. So that was so weird. And amputate his leg so that he can wear skinny jeans. And you know, these guys, they want to look good. And I thought, so are you telling me with his leg, he doesn't look good? Like my son was in the appointment with us and I had to stop him from talking, which I know he didn't like, but I said, please, just a moment. I turned to my son. I said, you are so cool with your leg. You're cool. Your leg hanging out at the bottom of your pants is so cool. Cause everybody has even me, I have 2 long legs, and nothing extra special going on here. So don't ever let anybody tell you that that's not cool. And, I thanked him for his time and I let him know that we will not using his services as a surgeon. And he was dumbfounded. He was like, this is what I do. I said, no, I know, but you're not the only person who does it. And I went to Shriners Hospital after that. And my first surgeon was a Jewish, gay woman. And now our doctor is Dr. Hamdi originally from Egypt. And, yeah, I absolutely love the services that we receive at Shriners Hospital. And I mean, in Quebec, there is so much racism. I will say in Shriners, wonderful. The entire team. When we leave the hospital, I can't even begin to speak about that. But Shriners Hospital has the most diverse employees I've ever seen in my life, who remember our name when we haven't been back to Montreal in a year. We walk through the door, they remember our name, they remember the procedures we had, and I've never received medical care or had my son receive medical care like we have at Shriners Hospital. It's usually some kind of drama that we deal with. And a lot of time, yeah, they're kind of appealing to looks and hip hop and kind of, and I barely listen to hip hop music, which is, I mean, I listen to a lot of range of music, but I'm not twerking in my living room, that's for sure. So it's just so strange. It's so strange, but conversations about twerking, which is mind boggling when I'm going for medical services, but this is common. And sometimes I do believe people are trying to find a common ground and relate, make me feel comfortable. But I think just talking to people is always the best way to go, just like they're a person. And I can't say we always get treated that way. I kind of have to snap people into sense, and then they realize really quickly my boundaries.
Okay, yeah, I couldn't have said it better myself, Tina. I also wanted to say that, you know, it's just so amazing to hear how you're so encouraging and supportive of your son, because for any child, that's so important, and more power to you as a parent who's encouraging him and supporting him. So this is an amazing thing to hear. So thank you so much for that. So my question is, how can healthcare providers better support members of the Black community who have disabilities?
Well, I mean, with us, we deal in physical disabilities. So prosthetic clinics need a range of limb colors. That's huge. Just so representation and being represented properly, especially when you're basically wearing a limb, you're hoping it's going to match your skin tone. And that doesn't usually happen very often. I think just having, you know, hiring more diverse healthcare professionals is really, really important, because we all bring something to the team. So I would like to see teams, like medical teams, of diversity. I want people there from all different parts of the world who bring different information and knowledge. And I think that would be a more cohesive way to give medical care. You know, a lot of medical books, really all medical, everything is from a white standard. So even when they talk about ailments, you know, the skin will be red and swollen. My skin doesn't get red and swollen, never, like, no. So there has to be different descriptions, and factoring skin color into the descriptions of things to look for. I know a doctor just did that recently. He launched a book of skin disorders, specifically for people of color, and what that would look like. Because when you're Googling and you're looking for a white bump or a red, you know, that's not appearing on our skin. So they also have to, they really have to factor in skin color to adversity and what things will look like, so that people are being diagnosed properly and also know what to look for. I mean, there's a lot of things compounding, you know, socioeconomic issues when it comes to disability access, resources for children with disabilities, for adults living with disabilities. Like, there are so many levels underneath the umbrella that need fixing. But funding is always going to be the first and foremost thing. You know, there has to be more funding for people with disabilities, for the amount of appointments that you have to go to, the amount of work and just life experiences that you have to miss out on to accommodate your disability needs compensation and proper compensation. Specifically, resources for Black people. I'm just trying to brainstorm off the top of my head. I always think communication is like key to everything. So there just needs to be a lot more research done. You know, I'm a researcher, that's within my career realm. So I believe research is very important, because you need to actually talk to people and know what are their needs, what is lacking. I think there's this misconnection between kind of low income communities, which are highly populated, you know, with people of color. Definitely, that's something I didn't experience. Again, both of my parents are academics, so I grew up in the suburbs. I didn't grow up in low income areas or anything like that. So again, I do a lot of listening because from my perspective, I always say I grew up with Black privilege. Both of my parents married madly in love, you know, dancing around the living room. So I grew up surrounded by love, surrounded by like protection. And my parents were huge advocates of any kind of injustice just because economically they could, and, you know, they could afford lawyers, things like this, you know? So I know we need to listen more to what people need to actually get the proper resources to them. And I think there just really needs to be a lot of more surveys, actual going into communities and creating real resources. Like, there's always talk of like funding and this, but it's usually a bunch of academics in a room talking about what's needed in the low-income communities, and nobody in that room lives in a low-income community. So I find that to be kind of rubbish, where I want the people in those areas to tell me what they need, and then I want to use my privilege to write laws, you know, get things pass through legislation, you know, find the funding, because that's my realm, you know, that's what I can do. So yeah, that's, I just think, you know, a lot of us, a lot of Black people with, or people of color with privileges, it's our job to now turn around and use those privileges to create more opportunity for people of color, and break down doors and continue to advocate and continue to question and confront and really dismantle anything that isn't pro accessibility.
Oh, wow. Thank you for that. That was very, these are very much needed conversations. And I'm so glad that I could be a part of this one today. Are there any changes you would like to see from the Black community when it comes to consideration for the disabled community?
Yes, I believe in theories. So I have some theories for things. Definitely unproven. Haven't done the research to back it up yet. But, you know, when I'm in like disability groups, a lot of time there, I can count the amount of Black people who are in that room. So in some ways, you know, there's this belief anyway, that there's not a huge prevalence of Black and disabled bodies, which is a lie, you know? Black people are already facing a lot of adversity. And I don't think all the time, you don't always have the energy, the time, the resources to be on the forefront of change. You know, some people are just really trying to survive and get their children the services and, you know, their needs met. But I believe that we need to be more vocal about it. Like the amount of Black people who write me or you know, message me just like, wow, I love how open you are about your son's disability. And I always take that as such a strange compliment. It's like, my disability is invisible. I think it's actually pretty magnificent that his is on the outside. So he doesn't even have to tell you certain things. You just know. It's something that, you know, if you have a child who is disabled in any way, or I don't even believe anybody's disabled. I believe we live with disabilities, right? I feel like the community is actually disabled and they're looking through broken eyes, but we're just different. So I just want Black people to celebrate all of our differences, you know, regardless of what that is. So I've seen people who have children who maybe have muscular dystrophy, but they don't really take them to events and they don't really bring them out in the community. And some of it is, you know, you don't know how people are going to look at you. Because yes, people look at me all kind of ways when I'm out with my son, and I have to look back at them like, really? Don't do that. Come on. Some days aren't fun. But there's no way I'm going to stay hiding anywhere. I feel like let's live out loud and proudly, no matter who you are. So I like, you know, challenge Black folks to do that, to be like, I'm going to have a disability event and I want everybody in this event to bring somebody with a disability and let's celebrate this. Like, this is what it is. But yeah, there's this kind of erasure of Black bodies and spaces, Black disabled bodies. And it's not always a conversation that's had. And I just feel like, let's talk about it. I think it's really cool. It's really unique. But you see a lot of white and disabled bodies. all over the place. I just want to see a lot of Black and disabled bodies being celebrated as well. Whether that's, you know, modeling, I'm seeing a lot more models of color and Black models who are with physical disabilities and wheelchairs, you know, things like that. So this is what I want to continue to perpetuate, is Black people supporting these type of movements and creating fashion shows and making sure that there are disabled bodies in those shows, and creating clothing and clothing lines to be inclusive. Having inclusive clothing lines. It's great to have a really cute, you know, sweatsuit, but is it tearaway so that, you know, certain bodies can get in it, you know, accessibly, you know, and thinking outside of the box and including everyone, because we know what it feels like to be discredited and forgotten. And we cannot do that to the Black disabled people in our community. Like, we need to be seen, and not just seen, we need to be on the forefront. One in every 10 people is affected by disability on some level in their family, and one in every 5 people lose some form of physical abilities in their lifetime, whether your ankle's sprained. Okay, get to the fridge. Now you know, it's only a short experience of physical impairment. But yeah, it's time for disabilities to be just an inclusive aspect of everything. And again, I will go back to birthing a child with disabilities. It needs to start like exactly right there, where I would love to create a program or create something, again, where you meet families and who are born, children born with disabilities. And from right there, you start having a support system and a network. So especially families of color, you know, I would have loved to go to the hospital. It's like, yep, there's 5 children born today. I will meet with all 5 families, give them resources, CHAMPS, WARAMPS, PFFD, places to begin to look and to belong. And I think we need more places like that to belong. And that's even what I would love PFFD to do. This is why we help people in redeveloping countries. Specifically, we're helping Africa first and foremost, you know, because we were all stolen and all the riches of Africa have been siphoned out of the continent. And I believe as an African, it's my duty to return some of these riches back to Africa. Well, I want all of the riches returned back to Africa, but I will do what I can in my lifetime. So yeah, I'm just, each of us is just paying rent on this universe who have certain privileges. And again, having cast on my legs and having to tell people that I'm disabled is a privilege in itself. And I'm going to use that privilege to bring forth change. So I challenge every Black person to look inside themselves and what kind of change can they be in the world? And specifically for those with disabilities, you know, developmental to physical, you know, mental illness, there's ranges to this. And some people even are affected by diabetes, you know, and they lose their limbs somewhere along life. Having supports in these ways too, and groups that people can really belong to, not like an AA, but, you know, kind of like an AA, like a real support group, where you can go and talk about losing your limb, what kind of experiences you've been going through, bullying, just all the things, navigating through the medical system. CHAMPS, WARAMPS is the only thing that exists like that. And that's wonderful for children. It really is. And for parents, but, for people of color, again, they didn't have a lot of information when it came to like race-based needs. And again, that just turns on the light bulb in my mind of realizing, okay, how do we fill that void? How do I fill that void, and what can I do? And then again, you just ask others to do the same. And sometimes when you do it, it gives people permission to do it as well. Like the Nelson Mandela speech, you kind of let your own light shine and then naturally others just begin to radiate as well. So that's my advice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you so much for that, Tina. Now, before we come back and chat more, we're going to go for another quick song break. Monica, who are we listening to next?
Thank you, Arthi. So our third song of the show is Air Ali by Naya Ali. Welcome back to All Access Pass on CITR 101.9 FM. The song you just heard was Air Ali by Naya Ali. Naya Ali is a Montreal-based Ethiopian rapper. She released part one of her debut album, Godspeed, last year in March 2020, and she will be releasing the next part this spring in 2021. She is also one of this year's inaugural winners of the SOCAN Foundation's SiriusXM Black Canadian Music Awards, a Canadian music award that recognizes up-and-coming Black artists.
Thanks for all the songs, Monica. Let's get back to our interview with our guest, Tina Opoleke.
Hey. Are you working on any projects that our CITR listeners would love to know about?
Let me think of some upcoming projects. Well, we have PFFD has just partnered with Legs for Africa, which is a charity in the UK that has shipped over 10,000 prosthetics to Africa. So we are the Canadian rep. So anybody across Canada that has prosthetics, we collect them. And with the help of Legs for Africa, they will be shipped immediately. We just shipped over 250 prosthetics to Africa, December 2020. So that was super exciting, and they just arrived about 10 days ago. So that's really exciting. I took a position as a interim writer for CBC Manitoba. So they kind of asked me to write opinion pieces, definitely having to do with disability. So I wrote an article about navigating through disability while Black. So definitely check out for that article. It was really cool. And just explaining just being a mother and having to advocate for my son, it's hard enough, you know, just meeting his needs and then roadblocks being put in my way. So that was a really awesome article, and it's a really great opportunity with CBC. There's some other things I can't talk about because they have to stay in the vault. PFFD is still working on creating a recycling program, like a repurposing program that could go across Canada. It's definitely still in the works, but this could create employment specifically for amputees, veterans, you know, older amputees who a lot of times it's really challenging to find work, especially for people with physical disabilities. There's a stigma that's placed along with the physical disability. So, you know, having drivers picking up prosthetics across provinces would be amazing. And just creating a repurposing program in all hospitals and all prosthetic clinics, which can really bring down the waste that's going into our landfills, because, you know, our carbon footprint is super important. And just being a global citizen, this could be huge in facilitating mobility across the world. We're still in the planning phases, but this is what PFFD is trying to do. And then also creating a network of like certain products I want to see. Right now, myself and an illustrator named Oreo, we're working on a coloring book celebrating some amputees that people don't know about. Super amputees, definitely my son is one of the amputees in the book, but like amputees like Frida Kahlo that used her wheelchair a lot, but a lot of people aren't aware. You know, they know she's an amazing artist, but she's not always represented as being amazing and disabled. So I want to have more of this like literature and more visuals of like people being disabled and how awesome that is. So yeah, that coloring book's in the works, and then that's going to be a fundraiser for PFFD. But also I just really believe like it would have been lovely to have a coloring book with disabled children when my son was growing up, but I couldn't find it. So this is also, PFFD wants to create some products specifically for people, wheelchair users, you know, to kind of have some cool items in their toolkit, you know, and have some accessible items for disabled children to celebrate their disabilities. And I feel like even children who are non-disabled should be having coloring books with kids in wheelchairs and, you know, with crutches and braces on their legs and you know, shoulder prosthetics and all kind of things and myoelectric arms, and then also to read about it and to understand. So those are kind of some of the things that are going on in the works for right now. We are always taking prosthetics and always shipping prosthetics. So every week we usually get a box shipped from somewhere and just collecting them to hopefully ship off to Africa in the next month or two. We're still waiting for more, but we're aiming for about every 3 to 4 months, depending on how many donations we get. But we're trying to ship off prosthetics for dismantling where they get dismantled in Nova Scotia and then shipped off to Africa after that. So yeah, that's kind of the upcoming things in the works. I'm also working on a book of poetry, just again, to inspire people and to share my voice and the thoughts and the words that I have in my spirit that I kind of keep to myself and don't always have anybody to talk to. Yeah.
Thank you so much for chatting with us today. And last but not least, is there anything you'd like to say to our listeners?
I would like to say that I think the world of disability is one of the most wonderful worlds to belong to. It's also kind of VIP and exclusive because you have to experience it to be a part of it. It's been one of the greatest experiences of my entire life. And I just want to tell everybody, celebrate your differences, celebrate how unique and beautiful and just amazing that you are. Not everybody can understand us and understand what we go through. And that's okay too, because we're all a part of this kind of beautiful tribe. And I'm just really grateful and honored to be a part of your tribe. You guys check out PFFD at PFFD INC. Anybody has prosthetics or across the GTA, really across Canada, get a hold of us at prostheticsffd@gmail.com or check me out, Queen TD, Queen TITE. Contact me. I'm always available and always ready to answer questions or support those with physical disabilities.
Yeah, thank you so much. And that wraps up our show for today. Tina, thank you so, so, so much for joining us today. We really appreciated you speaking about your family's challenges and the struggles faced by Black people with disabilities. Thank you so very much for your time and for all the work that you do. To our listeners, thank you for tuning in, and we hope you were able to learn a lot from the amazing Tina Queen Titi Opaleke.
I'm echoing Arthi. Thank you so much, Tina. This was amazing, so we really appreciate it. If you are interested in joining our team or think that there's an issue we should bring up on our show, please send us an email at accessibilitycollective@citr.ca.
Another special thank you to Queena Queen Titi Opaleke for chatting with the Accessibility Collective today.
Please like our All Access Pass Facebook page.
And if you're on Twitter or Instagram or both, please follow us at @access_CITR.
And if you missed part of our live show today and want to listen again, or maybe you want to listen to one of our past shows, you can do so on CITR.ca by going on the search box and typing in All Access Pass.
Take care and stay safe. Stick around for more CITR programming coming up next. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
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 Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tina. Thank you.
Hello, everybody. This is Jake McGrail of CITR Sports, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the unceded grounds of the Musqueam people. You're listening to Thunderbird Eye on CITR 101.9. Always keep you up to date with the latest UBC Thunderbirds news and stories. We have a very fun interview for you all this week, as Mike Liu sat down with the president of the UBC Dance Club, Juliana Chow. They discuss the structure of the club and all of its events, how they find a fit for people of all skill levels, and how she has taken the task of running such a social group from a social distance. Elsewhere, we have news from the UBC Aquatic Center and our recent Thunderbird draft picks, while the whole UBC community mourns the loss of one of the biggest figures in